Before we bring you this month's podcast, which was recorded before the movement restrictions were imposed here in the UK, we wanted to tell you about something new. The Slightly Foxed Archive contains more than 1,000 articles about individual books and authors written by world-famous writers, journalists and expert enthusiasts, and it's hard to imagine a more varied collection. Now, usually, all those articles are only available to Slightly Foxed subscribers, but with millions of people staying at home, everyone needs a good stock of reading material. So editors Gail and Hazel have decided to publish a collection of pieces for anyone to read. A free article will be released every week, and you can find them all on the website, foxedquarterly.com. Happy reading. Hello and welcome back to Slightly Foxed. Hoxton Square in East London, where you'll find the Slightly Foxed office, is about as urban as London gets, but we are heading for the West Country this month. There are three foxes with me, editors Hazel Wood and Gail Perkis, and their colleague Anna Kirk. My name is Philippa Lamb, and I'll introduce our guest in a moment. First, though, Anna, what's going on?
Well, we're about to receive delivery of the new summer publications, the new issue of Slightly Foxed.
Number 66.
Full of good things. So we've got an article on Penelope Chetwood's Two Ladies in Andalusia. She was married to John Betjeman, and she went travelling, well, alone horse ride through Spain, and it's her diary of this time, and she would read like Don Quixote while riding. She's quite an extraordinary woman.
Okay.
We also have a new plain foxed edition of Christabel Beelenberg's The Past Is Myself, which was one of our Slightly Foxed editions. It was very popular, so we're bringing that back. And then finally, we have our new Slightly Foxed edition, The Empress of Ireland by Christopher Robbins, which is essentially the story of his quite unlikely friendship with the Irish director Brian Desmond Hurst, who is not so well known now, but is quite a character. His daily breakfast was going to a pub. He would pick up an orange on the way and demand from the barman to have a glass of champagne, into which he would squeeze half the orange, knock that back, and then ask for another glass of champagne for the other half of the orange.
So, sounds good to me.
Yes, lots of entertainment coming.
That sounds great. Thank you very much, Anna. We will have book recommendations from everyone around the table a bit later on, after a specially recorded reading from the classic novel Tarka the Otter. But first, let's welcome this month's guest. Tim Piers is a British author rooted in the West Country, a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature. His first novel, In the Place of Fallen Leaves, won the Hawthornden Prize in 1993. His second, In a Land of Plenty, was made into a BBC TV series. That book saw his writing compared to Balzac. Thomas Hardy is another regular comparison. And nine novels later, it's all still going rather well, not least with the publication of the last volume of his West Country trilogy just last year. Tim, welcome.
Thank you, Philippa, and thank you all for inviting me.
Now, you grew up on the edge of Dartmoor, didn't you? We are mostly focusing on your West Country novels today, but for people who don't know that part of the world, and I have to include myself in this, how would you characterise it?
Wow, that's a very big question to start with. How to characterise Devon?
Where
I grew up in particular is in a village called Trusham, and it's between Exeter and Dartmoor. It's in the Tyne Valley. The name of the village in Anglo-Saxon meant the place of fallen leaves, which became the title of my first novel.
Yeah.
And it's on a hill, a Haldon Hill, that has always been a forested hill leading down into the valley. And the village itself is in a kind of cut out, a kind of coombe, scooped out of the side of the hill, a kind of crooked place. I don't know that that characterises the whole of Devon, but for me, that kind of epitomises the kind of crooked landscape. Windy lanes with high hedges.
Did it feel very rural?
When you're growing up, what one lives in is all one knows. And it certainly was. It was a very small village, just over 100 people. My sisters and I went to school in Exeter every day. I, for one, was very happy to get back.
What was it you liked about it?
The freedom, you know, a childhood of being able to walk out of the door, do what one wanted.
Because this is home turf for you as well. I'm literally the only person around the table who doesn't know anything about this. Hazel, you grew up there,
yes.
Or thereabouts.
Well, I grew up actually on the coast, but part of my childhood was going up onto Dartmoor, where we used to paddle in the stream and so on. And it was very remote and idyllic, and sort of just after the war, it felt very remote.
I remember as a boy one day at this time of year in the valley, the Tin Valley, full of primroses. And I remember speaking to an old chap and I said, "Oh, it's a lovely day, isn't it?" He said, "There'd be too many primroses about." Which I thought, I don't know what too many is.
Your first book, you said, In the Place of Fallen Leaves, it was set there. Hmm. Tell us a bit about it.
It started off as a story of a girl whose father has lost his memory, and they decide to get, or she decides to help him to find his memories, lost memories. And the book kind of changed a lot in the writing and gradually enlarged to become a story of their family over generations and a kind of picture of the village. A picture which is on the one hand an idyll and on the other hand has kind of secrets that were going to make it impossible for her to stay there.
It's one summer, isn't
it? One summer, yes, which is a kind of conflation of the summers of 84 and 85. And I also wanted to produce a book that was very much about Britain at that point, the Thatcherite era of greed and looking out for oneself and how that could infect any community.
So did you mine your own childhood experience much for it?
Very, very little of my experience. Although, funnily enough, it's coming back. No, I mean, one character, this girl, has a very particular relationship with the priest of the village. He's some kind of mentor for her.
Okay.
And that was a portrait of my father. That's the only portrait of someone I know in any of my books.
How was it growing up with a clergyman as a father in a small community? Was it like being the doctor's son? You had to be on your best behaviour?
Not really. I mean, he's my hero, really. My dad is, although he died 30 years ago. He was a liberal. He really believed that his children had to make their own minds up about things and live their own lives.
Because you evolved in a not very predictable way. I think I was reading up on your kind of early career, and even though you're kind of Oxford literati now. Actually, you had all sorts of jobs when you were young, didn't you? And you left school very early, 16 you left school.
I just was very uncomfortable at school, probably uncomfortable in my own skin as well, but very unhappy with the restrictions of school. I just couldn't really deal with it, I think. And so, yeah, I left. That was to my father's despair. And he then tried to get me to take on a trade. But I kind of already knew that I wanted to... I didn't know what kind of writer I wanted to be necessarily, but I knew I wanted to do something of that nature. So I had to find my own way through that. So I did a lot of menial jobs, some of which were a lot of fun. I had in many ways, extraordinary luck. One of the first things I did was, at that point, the Devon County Library was in a big Georgian house on the outskirts of Exeter, and they were shifting it into a purpose-built building in the middle of Exeter. And I got a job in the old place, and they still had two or three departments open to the public. So they had to have somebody on the front desk. About three people would come in every day. And they still had a lot of fiction in the basement that they hadn't yet moved. So every day when I was on the front desk, I would just go down to the basement and I would choose a different author for the week. Instead of doing A-levels at school, I was reading, you know, one week I read Nabokov, another week I read Grey and Green. I mean, it was fantastic.
But you did all sorts of things, didn't you? I've got a list here, farm labourer, nursing assistant in a mental hospital, night porter. You must have learned a lot about the human experience doing those jobs.
I think I probably did, you know, but a lot of them are very tedious and sometimes hard work.
Thinking about your other work, I mean, you've played with a lot of locations and eras. Would it be fair to say the themes are pretty consistently about family?
Yes, absolutely.
And change.
Absolutely. But I remember reading an interview with Martin Amis quite a long time ago, and he said something like, what I do is I'm at the front of the boat looking through the mist, trying to make sense of what's just in front of us. And I thought, that is the boat that I want to be on. But I'll be at the back of the boat, chronicling the times that we've just gone through. And I thought, that's what I'm doing. So that's what I did for my first seven novels.
So you're telling stories of families and using that as a means of talking about a particular time and place.
Yeah, I grew up in the 70s, you know, the kind of feminist era where the notion of the personal being political. So everything I wrote in those years was very much about how the kind of wider political currents of our time are felt by people and how we relate to each other.
So I read last year on Gail's recommendation your West Country trilogy, which I think you published the last one last year, didn't you? I absolutely loved it. But that's a different thing to what we've been talking about, isn't it? Because they're set much earlier. Do you want to give us a little snapshot of what they are?
Well, can I go back a bit?
Yeah.
So I wrote these novels, chronicles of the times I've just lived through. And my father, who I mentioned already, he had an interesting war, as they say. In the Second World War, he was a student at Oxford in 1939 and went and volunteered and was in North Africa in the artillery. And after the end of the Battle of El Alamein, he wasn't wounded. He got malaria and had to stay behind while the rest of his regiment came back to Britain. And he was in Cairo recuperating, and he went to a bar and got chatting to someone. And on their fifth gin and tonic, this other guy said, "You don't want to stay in artillery, dreadful business. You want to get into intelligence." So yeah, my dad said, "Yes, yeah, sure." And the guy said, "Well, look," and he wrote an address on a piece of paper and said, "Go around there tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock." And so my dad did, and he found himself being interviewed by three colonels, elderly colonels. And they said, "What do you know of politics?" And my dad said, "Well, I'm not really a political animal." And they said, "What do you know of Yugoslavia?" And he said, "I know nothing. I've never been there." And these three old chaps, they sent my dad to a corner of the room, and he could just overhear them conversing. And the most senior one said, "Knows nothing about politics. Completely ignorant about Yugoslavia. Just the kind of chap we need."
Okay.
And 6 weeks later, having done lessons in explosives, wireless operation, and Serbo-Croat, he was dropped by parachute into Yugoslavia, which about, I don't know, maybe up to a dozen other young intelligence officers were being dropped in different parts of it, because it was occupied by the Germans, and we just didn't know what was happening there. Anyway, to cut a long story short, he discovered that actually there was a fully organised communist partisan army. He became a liaison officer with them, and Churchill made this, at the time, very radical decision to back the partisans away from the royalist Serbs that we had been officially backing before then. Anyway, so that was my dad's war, and my sisters and I grew up with the stories that he told us. And my dad wanted to write about it. After the war, he came back to England and he wrote a number of short stories that were published, but a combination of his ministry as a priest and bringing up a family took all his energies, and it was something he looked forward to doing in retirement and then ran out of time.
And so you did it for him, really?
So I can't. Well, he had a very rough memoir, and the most interesting parts of which covered his time in Yugoslavia. Since, you know, after he died, I've been incredibly interested in Yugoslavia. I had travelled through as it was on the brink of civil war in the 1990s. And when a number of British troops were in Afghanistan, I was thinking a lot about what occupation means, the relationship between occupier and occupied, whether it's a benign occupation or a malign one. And I kind of clicked with Yugoslavia in the Second World War and my dad's experiences. So I wrote this novel, which is not about him.
And this is In the Light of the Morning.
In the Light of Morning. Without even deciding to, I'd written a historical novel. And this was a huge change for me, which I absolutely loved. I always do a lot of research for my novels, but I went to Slovenia. I met lots of people, including these very elderly people who'd been teenage partisans. And I spent months and months and months in the Bodleian Library in Oxford.
How lovely.
And it was a huge effort to actually stop doing the research and think, wait a minute, you're not an academic.
I hadn't understood this was the big step change in your career, one sort of writing to the sort of writing you're doing now.
I mean, the detail in your research is quite fantastic. And I wondered how you managed to, you know, at what point you think that's enough, I've now got to go into my imagination.
It's terribly difficult, really.
It must be so difficult.
I mean, all the detail, particularly in the first book, of rural life on this estate.
This is The Horseman, isn't it? Set in Edwardian England.
You know, the smithy and the breeding of horses and early veterinary practice. Where did all that come from?
I'm very fortunate living in Oxford that the Museum of English Rural Life is just down the road in Reading. They have not only a great library, but also a lot of archive film. I remember maybe my second trip there, watching some black and white film, probably from the 1930s maybe, in an old forge. and a scene of these blacksmiths who were going to put the iron wheels on the outside of the big wooden wheels of a big wagon.
The rim.
The rim. And they'd got it white hot in the forge, and they lifted two men with one side each with these tongs, took it out, put it over the wooden wheel. Then they stepped back, and one of them pulled a lever which dropped what the wheel was on down into a pool of water. And there was this incredible hissing and steam and everything. Brilliant, brilliant craftsmanship.
Yes.
And this is the opening scene of the first novel, isn't it? The
exactly,
boy, Leo,
yes.
watches exactly that
yes,
happen.
Yes.
The books are, even though the central characters, they persist throughout, they are very, very different. The first one is about when Leo is a boy.
Yes, so the first book is really about life on this estate. Leo's father is a ploughman, a horseman, on one of the half dozen farms on the estate.
On the edge of Exmoor?
Yes.
I mean, did you have a particular location in mind?
Well, funnily enough, I was saying how much research I do for my books. This book, for a reason that is only in retrospect that I can understand, I didn't do any research at all. I never went anywhere. I didn't find a location. It's kind of all dreamed up. And I think it's because it's about these two children, just pre-adolescent children, and I wanted, I think, it's almost like a kind of dream world where they're very connected to reality, but they're also in their own worlds. So that's the first book, is the life of this boy, Leo. His father has an affinity with the horses that he works with, and so does the boy. And all he wants is to follow in his father's footsteps. The girl, Lottie, is the only child of the aristocrat who owns the whole estate, who's a widower. And it's about Leo and Lottie's relationship, which is one of a shared love of horses.
There is a key event at the end of the first novel, which we will not go into. We haven't read it yet. And the second novel, The Wanderers, same people, entirely different canvas.
Yes, the second book follows Leo's journey from the Devon-Somerset border all the way across the peninsula down to Penzance and the adventures he has on the way. And that's interspersed with Lottie's experiences growing up fixed on the estate.
She's static, and he's with gypsies.
He's with gypsies initially, and then on a farm for a while, and then with a strange hermit.
Tell me about the gypsy research, because there's a lot of detail. It was revelatory to me and fascinating, because you don't romanticise them at all.
I hope I don't romanticise anything. It's a very difficult thing, writing about the past, writing about a rural past, writing about that long summer before the war, the First World War. It's so difficult not to romanticise. Yes. I didn't do research for the first book. This book, I walked every bit that Leo does.
Did you?
Not really? In one go, but in stages.
That's a long way. So,
because he does it in stages.
He goes across the moor, doesn't he?
Yeah. You know, we're talking about imagination, but they're also, for me, as I think of myself as a realist writer, and I love doing research of different kinds. And you go into a place, you know, of course you see things that you would never have thought up at your desk. I remember on Dartmoor one day, there are these wonderful leats, as they're called, aren't
yes.
they? They carry water across the moor. And I was standing beside one, and I saw this sheep coming down this leat. And I thought, what a clever sheep, you know, because they've got these little spindly legs. What a clever sheep to work out that it can take a shortcut, you know, using the leat. And then realise what an idiot I was. The sheep was obviously dead. It drowned. And it was just
bumping along.
It was just bumping along this leat.
And then the third book, The Redeemed, that's a wartime novel, isn't it?
Well, it's a wartime and after, yes, absolutely. So Leo has gone away, and the second book takes us between 1911 and 1914, and then we're into the war.
And away from the West Country.
Absolutely, away from the West Country. And the old hermit that he stays with has advised him, there's a war coming, get on the ship. So he enlists in the Navy. And then it follows his adventures there and afterwards. But there's always this, at the end of the first book, he says to Lottie, I'll come back, basically. And in his mind, he's kind of pledged himself to her.
We should talk about Lottie's journey, really, shouldn't we? Because obviously Leo's the central character, but Lottie is very significant. Now, her journey is static, isn't it, in that she remains in the West Country. She's a gentleman's daughter on this estate, her father's estate. She's pursuing her own life, but she blossoms into something very unexpected, doesn't she? She has her own sort of journey.
She does indeed, absolutely.
And becomes a vet.
She becomes a vet, yes. Again, one doesn't plan these things, but when I found out that the first women to come up to Camden Veterinary College, it was in, I think it was in 1926, which fitted exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. And sort of, wow, you know, it just fitted.
So you just heard that and kind of thought, okay, that's a perfect thing for her to do. And
well, I already wanted her to be doing that.
And then it's more research and more detail about early veterinary techniques and more time on research.
Yeah, absolutely.
How long did it all take?
This trilogy didn't take very long to write, to be honest, probably 4 years, which is, for me is very quick. Yeah.
How much writing did you do, Tim, before the first novel was published? I mean, it's perfectly formed and it's sort of seemingly sprung from nowhere.
You're right, we haven't bridged that gap between I was working in a library in Exeter and working as a hospital porter too, and then I wrote these very successful books. What happened in between, Tim?
Well, I wrote a lot of rubbish, really. A great deal, very bad stuff. And also, I didn't show it to anybody. From sort of 16 to 36, that's a long time, you know. Eventually I showed something I'd written, a short story, to a friend of mine. I was 28 or so, and I'd written lots and lots of poetry and stories about alienated young men wandering around Europe, failing to do this and that. Not autobiographical at all, but and they weren't very good. And then one day I'd wrote a story, it was really about my grandparents, but I set it in a village I'd grown up in. And suddenly there was a world that was real. Mm. It wasn't just a cerebral exercise. It was rooted in reality.
And you published it, that one?
No. The rest of it wasn't good enough. Yeah, I mean, it was a long haul. Yeah.
But you felt able to show your work to other people?
Yes.
Do you do a tremendous amount of sort of editing yourself?
I wish I did do that, Hazel.
Gail's rolling her eyes as a former editor.
Yes. Yeah. No, I was very fortunate. I'd written a novel set in the village and I'd sent it off to publishers and it had come back one or two nice things, but mostly negative. And I was working in the Museum of Modern Art as it was then in Oxford. And a woman who, Leslie, she said, send your new one to a friend of mine who's a literary agent. And the first time I used any kind of introduction like that, Juliet Burton, it was, who read it, and she said, why don't you come up to London and we'll have a chat and have a coffee. So I came up to London on the X90 bus, and Juliet said, look, there's some good writing in here, one or two interesting characters, but it's far too long. It's about 500 pages. Far too long. It meanders all over the place. There's no plot at all. You need to cut it by about a quarter, and then I might look for a publisher. So I went back to Oxford and I struggled, you know, because I thought it was perfect.
Yeah, really hard to do.
But anyway, I eventually did send it back and she sent it out to various publishers. Eventually, it got to Alexandra Pringle at Hamish Hamilton. And Alexandra said, yeah, if he wants to come out to London, have a coffee, we'll chat about it.
More coffee.
So I got back on the coach, met Alexandra, and she did this magical thing, which was she went through the manuscript, talking in quite apparently vague terms about what she liked, what she didn't like, what worked, what didn't work. And at the end of it, she said, there's some good writing here. She said, there's some interesting characters, but it's too long.
Too long.
And it goes all over the place.
Still.
She said, see what you think. She said, you might not want to change a word and it might be publishable as it is. And I got on that coach and I'll never forget it. My brain was literally fizzing with excitement because she had enabled me to see my work, you know,
hooray.
The magic of an editor. Yeah. And I returned it to her within about a week.
Cut.
I could see how it improved, you know.
That's so interesting. So she just held up a mirror to it so you could understand how it would be for someone to read it.
Yeah.
Editors, I always say, are midwives, and they can stand back and give their view. But particularly with a novel, it's the author who's got to do the work. But
yes.
Having the humility to take on advice, because I think some writers, you know, they're very pig-headed.
So you're that interesting place for a novelist now, and you've finished this trilogy. Now what?
I feel that this trilogy is, I've got the most out of whatever talent I have. So in a way, it's a kind of burden. has been lifted. So I'm just enjoying myself. I'm doing lots of different things, different writing projects. So I've been writing lyrics, comedic stuff, crime novel. It's all rubbish, but I'm really having a good time.
Rather than prod you about what you're going to write next, I need to ask you about Coco, because you have West Country connections with Gail, but you also have dog connections, don't you? Tell us about the dog. It's a cocker spaniel, like the Slightly Fox dogs, isn't it?
Well, I have two cocker spaniels, but Chudley, he's still untrained, aged 11.
Well, this is what made me laugh about it, because I read the piece on your website, Tim, about how she didn't turn out to be what you thought she was going to be when you picked her out of the litter.
I'm a writer. I want a dog that's not going to disturb one's peace.
So you chose a cocker?
Yeah, I wasn't going to say that, because I thought that would be unkind. But yeah, so... Did you not give thought to the breed before you decided you wanted a dog?
I relented to pressure from my wife and children. They wanted a cocker spaniel. Okay. But I didn't do enough research. You're quite right.
I've got a quote, actually, that I pulled off the essay. A tart and cantankerous canine, a muscly, meaty little thing who like growling at human beings and wrestling with other dogs. So not the tranquil dog you had in mind at all. And if you're interested, the essay and indeed a picture on Tim's site, and it's about writers and their dogs.
Thank you.
I think we'll call that a day. I remember you can find all the books we've talked about in every podcast, in fact, in the show notes attached to it on your podcast app. If you listen on the Slightly Fox website, as I know quite a lot of you do, you can also find them there. FoxedQuarterly.com is the place to go. We're going to move on now to an extract from an archive issue of the Slightly Fox magazine, which has been specially recorded for this podcast. If you already subscribe, you'll know what to expect. And if you don't yet buy the magazine, this will give you a taste of what you'll find in it. Each issue is a collection of pieces. They run to a few pages each. Each piece, it's a very personal take on a particular book. It's written by someone with deep knowledge and a real passion for it. The reading we're going to hear this month is about an author, also rooted very much in the West Country, in North Devon, in fact. But as you'll hear, he's a writer with characteristics which you might not perhaps associate with him if you've read the work. And I think a very different character to Tim, who's with us today. Gail, tell us about it.
Yes, it's Henry Williamson's novel, Tarka the Otter, which is set on the Tor and the Torridge Rivers. And the article is by Jonathan Law.
If we're honest, most of us have at least one friend that we would hesitate to bring into civilised company. Someone too strange or socially awkward, full of crazed notions, given to boring on or making horrible scenes. Something similar holds with writers. There are books and authors that we love quite unreasonably, but would hesitate to introduce to anyone nice. Often, these are the authors that we read and read again, however many times we've given them up in despair or disgust. Some knotty thoughts arise. Doesn't allowing ourselves to feel ashamed of someone always make us feel a bit ashamed of ourselves? Doesn't it imply a priggishness, at worst a kind of treachery? The bothersome chap who prompts these thoughts is Henry Williamson, author of Tarka the Otter, some lesser known but exquisitely written animal stories and 20 or so full-length novels, now largely unread except by a small band of cultists. Williamson seems a man made for mixed feelings. A naturalist of rare gifts, a writer with a unique voice and vision, but unquestionably a bore, a crank, and here it gets critical, an overt, unapologetic Nazi. His friends seem to have found him exasperating but lovable, a strangely feral, childlike creature. Others saw something very dark and had the perfect nickname, Tarka the Rotter. It's easy to feel attracted to the young Henry Williamson, the nerve-wracked war veteran, still in his early 20s, who makes his way to North Devon on a battered motorbike with a head full of Shelley and Richard Jeffries, who holes up in a tiny damp cottage, soon filled with cats, dogs, owls, gulls, a baby otter, and lives a hermit's or a tramp's life, exploring the wild country about him and starting to write it all down. He swims in the nude. He throws apples at local dignitaries. He scandalizes with his wild talk of Lenin and Christ. Okay, so he's a bit worrying after all. But there's something inspiring, too, about the way he comes to write Tarka, by a kind of deep immersion, plunging himself into the creature's habits and habitats, crawling through spinneys and splashing through rivers to get an otter's eye view of the world. In these early days, Otter Man took the same heroic trouble with his prose as he did with his fieldwork. Tarka was rewritten 17 times. Williamson is, or can be, a virtuoso stylist. While the pallor of the day was fading off the snow, a skein of great white birds, flying with arched wings and long, stretched necks, appeared with a measured beat of pinions from the north. Humpa, 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 high in the cold air. The beams of the lighthouse spread like the wings of a starfly above the level and somber sands. Across the dark ridge of the Sharshook, a crooked line of lamps winked below the hill. It's a kind of incantation, and Williamson uses it to sing a whole world into being, a dreamlike world of starlit weir pools, precipitous owl-hushed oak woods, and high moors of cotton grass and curlew song. There's a glamour to these landscapes that is almost physically haunting. So Tarka is probably some kind of masterpiece. But ask precisely what kind, and the questions begin to slide and wriggle and bite each other's tails. The first thought to go has to be that this is in any way kids' stuff. Severely anti-anthropomorphic. It's a long way from Watership Down, let alone Disney. Dog, eat bird, eat rat, eat fish. This is Williamson's great theme, and one that seems to inspire a keen ambivalence. It comes out strongly, and for many people uncomfortably, whenever Williamson writes about hunting. He identifies with the terror of the hunted stag or otter, but also with the fierce glee of the hunter, and with a mystical idea of life replenished through death. By night, the great stars flickered as with falcon wings, the watchful and glittering hosts of creation. The moon arose in its orbit, white and cold, awaiting through the ages the swoop of a new sun, the shock of starry talons to shatter the icicle spirit in a rain of fire. With Sirius the dog star baying green fire at his heels. At midnight, hunter and hound were rushing bright in a glacial wind, hunting the full star dwarves of burnt-out suns who had turned back into darkness again. Williamson has the power to astonish that we normally associate only with the great artists. If you have the patience and the stomach, you'll find passages of like power scattered throughout his works, even the mediocre or downright bad ones, not to mention those that are ideologically beyond anyone's pale. The question that most fascinates and troubles is how far Williamson's later views can be seen as a mad aberration, and how far they reflect toxins already latent in his thought.
Is it only me who didn't know he was such a bizarre person? That was an extract from Jonathan Law's piece on Henry Williamson's Tarka the Otter. It was from issue 35, and our thanks to the actor Rory Murphy for reading it for us. And by the way, I should tell you that subscribers, listeners, often get in touch to say they've discovered or even rediscovered a really wonderful book after reading one of the Slightly Foxed essays. Gail and Hazel love those messages, so please do let them know if that's been your experience. And of course, we always love to hear your thoughts on the podcast too. You can get in touch through the website, foxquarterly.com, or on Twitter, at foxquarterly is the handle. Book recommendations from everyone shortly after a brief word about Slightly Foxed. Elegant, eclectic and entertaining, Slightly Foxed is the literary quarterly for nonconformists. It introduces readers to all those wonderful books that languish on publishers' backlists but are often very hard to find in bookshops. Among its contributors are distinguished writers and novelists and people from other walks of life, all of whom share their passion for particular books and authors and write about them beautifully. Now, since it's entirely independent, Slightly Foxed is free to follow its own nose and celebrate the offbeat. So why not take out a subscription? £48 for an annual print subscription in the UK and Ireland, and £56 overseas. Your subscription also includes free access to all the back issues in the digital archive. Here's the web address, foxedquarterly.com, or if you'd rather talk to a human, give the office a ring on 020 7033 0258. Thank you. Well, as you know, our guests always come equipped with a recommended read. So, Tim, what do you have for us?
I've got a book called Omer Pasha Latas, Marshal to the Sultan by Ivo Andrić. He's a Yugoslav author, born in, I think, 1892 in Bosnia. As a young man, a young student, he was involved in politics. He was a close friend of Gavrilo's Princip, the assassin of Archduke Ferdinand, and spent the First World War under house arrest. After the war, he entered the diplomatic service, and during the Second World War, he went to Belgrade and wrote his two most famous books, Bridge Over the Drina and Bosnian Chronicle. This book, Omer Paschalatos, is just recently been translated. It's set in the 1850s in Sarajevo. Bosnia is kind of looked after by these various viziers, and everything's okay as long as people pay their taxes. But now, this man, Omer Paschalatos, this Saraskie, the head of a military mission, comes to Sarajevo to impose reforms. And the novel is really written from the viewpoint of us, the people of Bosnia. It tells a story of this man, but it then goes off into all sorts of digressions and from different people's points of view. For example, it starts with the grand entrance of the army into Sarajevo and this fearsome figure on a big white stallion at the centre of it, but it then goes into a madman in the crowd who does some embarrassing thing, and it goes off, and then we get three pages about his life.
So it zooms in, zooms out.
It goes in all over the place. It reminded me of Catch-22 in the way that it does that. It's just a wonderful book. Wonderful book. It's one of those books where I read it, and I just, every page I was eating up, you know.
Okay. Hazel.
Well, for quite a while now, I've been feeling that I ought to read something by Sylvia Townsend Warner, who I've never tried before. So I lit upon Lolly Willows. And it's the story of Laura Willows, who comes from a very, very traditional family, which truly values its past. They own a brewery and a rather beautiful country house. And there Lolly lives with her two brothers, her father and her mother. And her mother dies, and Lolly is very attached to her father. So when her father dies, the rest of the family, by this time, are grown up and married. They descend, and her rather pompous brother, Henry, and his very traditional wife, Caroline, decide that Lolly should go and live with them. So she goes to London, and she becomes the sort of spinster aunt, you know, much loved. This is all taking place, by the way, just before the First World War. So Lolly spends quite a long time there, but something in her soul is just sort of missing. Eventually, she finds a little village called Great Mop, and she decides to move there. And, you know, she's got to have something to live on. So she confronts Henry, who's actually made some very bad investments for her meantime, and has just about enough to live on. And she moves to Great Mop. And this is the point at which I thought I might give up, because there are all sorts of very strange signs and portents in this village. She hears music and people walking about late in the evening and so on, but she revels in being in the countryside. And gradually it becomes apparent that she's going to become a witch.
Ah, that's unexpected.
And she does. She joins the village as a sort of coven, and is sort of extremely happy there, and somehow sort of finds her independence. And I suppose at one level you could take this book as just a sort of nice whimsical tale. It's told in a very engaging, wry, observant way. But it is a sort of passionate plea, you know, for women's independence. And I think at the time it came out in 1926. She had an affair with a married man who was very interested in Tudor music, but she also got very interested in 16th century Scottish witchcraft trials and, you know, was sort of carried away by the idea that these women, with their very sort of humdrum lives, were finding something sort of romantic and fulfilling in witchcraft. Anyway, I did enjoy it, and Sylvia Townsend Warner was a very independent woman herself and went against the grain by living with her lover. So she was a kind of pioneer, and it is really rather gripping. It didn't immediately attract me, but it turned me on in the end.
Gail?
I don't want to embarrass Tim, but I am going to recommend his first novel, In the Place of Fallen Leaves. As he said, it's set in a little Devon village in a very hot summer in the mid-1980s. And it is about this girl, Alison, and her friendship with Jonathan, who's the heir to a viscountcy. There's a big estate nearby. it's so hot that the normal pattern of life is completely upturned. There's also a teacher's strike, so the children of the village can't go to school. She and Jonathan go swimming in a pool in the quarry. In fact, there are elements of it that reminded me of The Horseman, the same sort of friendship between disparate, well, children from very different backgrounds, exactly. But it's also a rather wonderful portrait of farming just as it was on the cusp of change, and this happens directly to the family because it's so hot, the grass fails, and they have this herd of cows that they in the end have to slaughter a lot of them because they simply can't afford to feed them. And the young man who's going to take over the farm has great plans to get EU subsidies to start using fertilizers, and you can see the changes that are going to take place. But rather like Tim's trilogy, it's a book that it's like entering a magic world and you just sort of disappear into it. And I started reading it for homework for the podcast, and I ended up just wanting to read it just for sheer pleasure. It's a joy, a real joy.
It sounds like you remember in much more detail than Tim did when I was asking about the story was earlier. You couldn't remember. Thank you all very much. Tim, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us.
Thank you, Philippa.
Visit the Slightly Fox website to subscribe to the Quarterly magazine, or indeed browse through the books you'll find for sale there. Foxquarterly.com is the web address, as I think you all know by now. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please do review and rate us on whichever app you use to listen. The more ratings we get, the more listeners we reach. We'll be back on the 15th of June. Thanks, as always, for listening and for joining us on this month's literary expedition, Off the Beaten Track.